What my wife and I found out when we were ski instructors in Colorado was that the most important thing was to get our students on the slopes and get them all excited about skiing. Technique, we found out, comes later. Fun and excitement come first. Then people learn 100 times faster. Get it? It's not normal or healthy to keep energetic young kids like you closed up in a classroom. By nature, you want to play and run and jump and have fun. So that's why I don't care about periods or commas or misspellings at this time, even though this is English class. What I want to do is to get you so excited about reading and writing that the love of learning will be with you for the rest of your lives. I don't want to hinder your natural joy of wanting to venture into a world of books and writing and wanting to learn. He stopped and looked around at all of us. Who likes what I've just said? He now asked with a big grin. I shot my hand up, and I thought that everyone else had shot up theirs. But I was wrong. A few cadets didn't raise their hands. All right, he said. For you that don't feel comfortable with this method of teaching, I'll keep you off the slope, and grade your papers for grammar and punctuation, too, he added. I found this very interesting. The cadets who hadn't put up their hands were our 3 regular A students and 1 of our C students. Myself, I was mostly a D student, but I also got some C's and C pluses now and then. All right, he said, start writing. And I repeat that the key point is, I shared with you what it is that I love to do, so now I want you to share with me what it is that you love to do. And I don't care about what it is. It can be about anything. All I want is to be able to feel the excitement of what it is that you love to do, he added with such vigor that I thought he would burst. Hearing that I didn't have to worry about misspellings and punctuation marks, I was given wings. My God, I'd never heard a teacher call himself a bum before, and then share with us stories about his own life with such passion. Quickly, I started writing about what it was that I had always liked to do the most when I'd been a kid. It was going horseback riding in the hills behind our home, taking my trusty Red Ryder BB gun or my big, tall bows and arrows so I could hunt squirrels and rabbits. But I could see that some of my fellow cadets didn't start writing right away. One of them wanted to know how much time we had. Another wanted to know how long our papers should be. Mr. Swift told us that we had the whole session to write, and our papers could be 2 to 10 pages long, that he'd collect our work at the end of the period, grade them tonight, and give them back to us tomorrow. Our top A student, Walrick, who also happened to be our class leader, wanted to know if we'd get higher grades if our papers were closer to 10 pages than 2. Yes and no, said Mr. Swift. I'll be grading on quality first, but quantity will also influence me. 100-yard dash, like my wife used to run, is a thing of beauty, but a full marathon is, he added, shaking his head, beyond belief. They continued talking, but I was already writing, so I didn't pay much attention to them anymore. I then began to write about my big older brother Joseph, who we'd always called Jose or Chava Boy in Spanish at home, and I wrote that he'd died when I was in the 3rd grade. That was the first time that I flunked a grade. Finally, I heard our substitute instructor tell Walrick, who continued asking questions, that discussion wasn't always a sign of an inquisitive mind, but could also be interpreted as procrastination. Then he told us to all get started right now. I was on fire. I was already into my 2nd page. My God, without the shackles of spelling and punctuation, I was flying. All these things were coming out of me. Now I was writing about how my big brother Joseph had been sick and in the hospital for a long time before he'd died. My parents were gone a lot of the time, visiting him down at Scripps Hospital in La Jolla, and so I was very happy that my brother's dog Shep had started to spend a lot more time with me. Because, you see, dogs, like cats and horses, wouldn't spend time with you unless they really liked you. I'd been 8 years old at this time, I wrote, and in the 3rd grade, and every afternoon after school, I'd go hunting with my bow and arrow and my brother Joseph's dog, Shep. Shep had been on the ranch when we'd moved from the barrio of Carlsbad to South Oceanside. Shep wasn't very big. He was half coyote and half sheepdog. And when we'd go hunting behind our ranch up the railroad tracks that ran inland from Oceanside to Vista, Shep never chased the rabbits or the squirrels like other dogs. No, he'd watch which way the squirrels or rabbits were headed. Then he'd race around, circling them real fast, beating a few of them to their holes. And those that didn't make it to their holes, he'd chase up a tree or fence post. Then, I saw him do this hundreds of times, Shep would get under the old tree or fence post, make eye contact with the squirrel, then he'd begin to circle with his tongue hanging out, salivating. That squirrel up in the tree or on a fence post would get so nervous watching him circle about below that he'd turn around and around, trying to keep his eyes on Shep. Then suddenly, Shep would change his direction and run really fast around the tree or fence post in the opposite direction, and that old squirrel would now get so dizzy that he'd fall out of the tree or off the fence post. Instantly, Shep would be on that squirrel, expertly grabbing him by the back of the neck and giving him one or two shakes with such force that he'd break the squirrel's neck, killing him. Every time we'd go hunting, Shep would get more squirrels than I could with my BB gun or bow and arrows. In fact, if the truth be told, my BB gun was so weak that the BBs wouldn't even penetrate the skin of a rabbit or squirrel unless I was super close. And with my big long bow, I was still so slow and clumsy that when I was in the third grade, I never got any game. I then concluded my paper by saying that for months I'd hunted with my brother's dog Shep before and after school, but then when my brother died, Shep ran off into the hills, never to be seen again. I couldn't believe it. I'd handwritten 9.5 pages. Boy, I'd been flying down that slope at 100 miles an hour. But I didn't want to stop, even though class was over and Mr. Swift was now collecting our papers. I still wanted to tell our teacher about how the Indian people who'd worked on the ranch for us had explained to me that Shep, who'd always loved my brother more than life itself, had disappeared because he'd run off to the highest hilltop to intercept my brother's soul so he could lead my brother's soul back to heaven. Dogs, cats, horses, all animals could do this at will much easier than us humans, Rosa and her husband Emilio had explained to me, because animals were much closer to God than we humans were. This was why Jesus had been born in a manger, to learn about love from the animals in the barn so that he could then do his most holy earthly work when he got big. I turned in my story, entitling it, "The Smartest Human I Ever Met, My Brother's Dog, Shep." And the next day, when I got my paper back, I had an A. Instantly, I knew that there was something really wrong with this substitute teacher. I'd never gotten an A in all of my life, so I took Mr. Swift aside to speak to him so he wouldn't get in trouble. "Look," I said to him, "you might know a lot about going down cliffs of snow and surfing, sir, but I don't think that you know too much about teaching." "Why do you say that?" he asked. My heart was pounding like a mighty drum. I knew that I'd be cutting my own throat by saying what I was going to say, but I had to. I didn't want Mr. Swift to get in trouble. I liked him. I really did. "Because, you see, sir," I said, my corazón beating, "I'm a Mexican, and so you can't be giving me an A. You've got to give me a D or C, or maybe you can get away with giving me a C+. Tears burst forth from my eyes. "Because I've had a few of those, but you can't," I added, feeling so tight in my chest that I could barely breathe, "give me an A. That's wrong, sir." He looked at me like he didn't know what I was talking about, took a deep breath, and gently put his hand on my shoulder. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. "All I know is that I never saw animals as being so smart and special until I read your story."
"Really?"
"Yes, really. And I'm now also convinced that your brother's dog, Shep, is the smartest human I've ever met. Tell me, is it part of your Indian upbringing to refer to animals as being human?" he asked. I shrugged. I didn't know how to answer his question. It was still very hard for me to sometimes know where my Catholic Christian upbringing stopped and my grandmother's Indian teachings began. For me, it was all like one big river running together with all these different waters. By the time our local San Luis Rey River got to the sea, who could tell which water had come out of which canyon, especially when you realized that the San Luis Rey River didn't just start at our towering Palomar Mountain some 30 miles inland, but actually started beyond Palomar in all that huge open eastern country where my dad and my uncle Archie liked to go deer hunting with Archie's relatives from the Pala Indian Reservation. "Okay, you don't need to know," he said. "Just keep writing as pure and honest as you wrote yesterday. I'm looking forward to reading what you'll write today. The A remains." I was double, triple, quadruple shocked. I'd never had an A in all my life. My heart was beating a million miles an hour. I wrote that day in class as I'd never written before, expanding on the story that I'd written about Shep and how on the night of my brother's death, Shep had howled all night long at the moon, and then he'd disappeared in the early morning hours of the night. Then I wrote that when our dad and mom came home that morning from Scripps Hospital in La Jolla and informed my little sister Linda and me that our brother Joseph had died, we weren't surprised, because Rosa and her husband Emilio had already told us. I began crying as I wrote. Mr. Swift came by and stroked me on the shoulder when he saw me crying. Class was over, but I'd been so far away in my writing that I hadn't even realized that class was over, and the rest of the cadets were getting up so we could be marched to our next class. My God, Mr. Swift had been right. Once we got out of the confines of spelling and punctuation, writing and reading could be so exciting. Sleeping, dreaming here in my hotel room in Long Beach, I remembered all this like it had happened in a faraway, foggy dream. My God, I really hadn't realized it, but I owed so much of my joy of reading and writing to that substitute teacher in the seventh grade who, in 3 tiny days, had touched my heart and soul. My eyes filled with tears. My God, how I'd like to find that teacher and give him a copy of my book, Macho. I breathed and breathed again. Teaching didn't have to be long and boring and laborious. No, teaching could be done as fast as a lightning bolt. He'd cut across the valleys of my deepest doubts, giving light to the darkest crevices of my beaten-down, inhibited mind, accessing a natural storytelling ability within me that was utterly profound. Oh, how I wished that I'd told those teachers yesterday about this Mr. Swift, or Mr. Smith. I couldn't really remember his name. But I knew that it had started with an S, followed by an all-American-sounding name. Wiping the tears out of my eyes, I stretched and breathed, and I woke up some more, hoping to God that I could at least find that man from the teachers' union today and tell him that, yes, he'd been right, and I'd found a wonderful teacher in my life who'd helped me along my way. I stretched some more, rubbing the sleep out of my eyes. I could now hear the quiet surf of the Long Beach Harbor outside of my window. I was on the 10th floor, and I could see that the light of the new day was just beginning to paint the eastern sky with colors of orange and yellow and streaks of pink. It was going to be another gorgeous day here in the paradise of Southern California. I could now very clearly see that that man from the teachers' union had been brilliant when he'd told me that wake-up talks were good, but the teachers also needed to know what worked in our system. Yesterday, when I gave my talk, I'd been so hot with rage that I hadn't been able to remember anything good that had ever happened to me in school. But now, this morning, after a good night's rest, I remembered some very good things, too. I could now remember so clearly that this substitute teacher, who I'll continue calling Mr. Swift, gave me not just wings, but asked me some questions that would provoke my mind for years. I'll never forget that day when I walked out of the classroom with the first A of my entire life. Instantly, the real A students, who'd been waiting for me, knocked my books out of my hand, and they grabbed my A paper away from me and started saying, "You didn't spell this right. You didn't use punctuation. How could he give you an A?" "What did you guys get?" I asked. They mumbled, but not very clearly, and crumbled up my A paper and threw it on the ground. I almost started to cry, but didn't, and when I bent down to pick up my books and my crumbled up paper, I found 2 hands helping me. I looked up, and saw that the two hands belonged to George Hillam. He was a day student like me, meaning that we got to go home every afternoon and sleep at our own homes. We didn't live on the school grounds like the other students.
"They got bees," said Hillam to me. "That's why they're pissed. And Walrick, he even got a D, and the teacher wrote on his paper that he knows where he got a lot of his story."
"You mean that Walrick copied?" I asked quietly as we picked up all my books and other stuff.
"No, he didn't copy, but he used material that wasn't his."
"I don't get it," I said.
"Look," said Hillam very patiently, "we were told to write about what we loved to do, and he wrote about what someone else had written that they loved to do, which was boating. Get it? He was trying to butter up our new teacher, like he always does with Moses and our other teachers."
"Oh, I get it," I said, finally understanding. "Because Mr. Swift had said that he and his wife are going to build a sailboat, he wrote about boating, but used somebody else's story, thinking that this was the best way for him to get a top grade out of our new teacher."
"Exactly," said Hillam. "What did you get?"
I then asked Hillam.
"I got an A2. I wrote about loving to bake cookies and eating them all," said Hillam, laughing so hard that his big belly shook up and down.
George was fat and one of the most well-liked guys in our whole grade. His father owned a grocery store in downtown Oceanside and was real tall and skinny. It was George's mother, who had the prettiest blue eyes in all the world, who was heavyset like George. Everybody was already standing in ranks. George and I were the last ones to get in file. It seemed like George and I were almost always late for everything. Usually George only got C's and B's. He was pretty excited about his A, too. For 3 days I got A's, and George did too. And finally I even forgot that I was Mexican and not a good student, and all those other derogatory things that had been pounded into my head ever since I'd begun school. For the first time in my life, I was no longer one of the slowest learners in my grade. No, I was simply becoming a regular kid who loved to come to school, work extra hard on my homework at home, and could hardly wait to get to school in the morning so I could go to English class. I was flying. I was an eagle shooting across the heavens. I was that red-tailed hawk that lived in the towering Torrey pines by our home and screeched with gusto every afternoon when I went hunting, causing flocks of dove and quail to take flight. And I now understood, for the first time in my life, why reading and writing had always seemed so boring and stupid. I'd never known that they were vital to our lives outside of the classroom. You see, Mr. Swift explained to us that the whole world communicated through reading and writing. A scientist learned about science through reading, then later in his career he expressed his findings to other scientists through writing. A farmer learned about new tractors and the new methods of farming through reading. Then he also told the world about any discoveries that he might have uncovered through writing. Years ago, Mr. Swift explained to us, it had all been done around the campfire, the sharing of stories and information. But now, in modern times, with the known world having gotten so much larger, it was all done through the written word. The plumber, the electrician, the lawyer, the doctor, the trainer of dogs and horses, everybody learned and communicated through the written word. And with a library card, he told us that we could learn the fundamentals of anything in all the world. Then, with hands-on experience, we had no earthly limitations. This was all so mind-boggling for me. I'd always thought libraries were for punishment, to get us to keep still and shut up. I'd never thought of all those books in the library as our gateway, as Mr. Swift said, to the whole universe of knowledge. Now I was writing about Midnight Duke, the most noble horse we'd ever had on the ranch, who'd break down gates or climb over fences to be at the side of a mare who was going to foal, so he could guard her against the coyotes who lived below our house in the swampy area, where the sea came into our inlet of fresh water. But then, on the fourth day, when I came in to show Mr. Swift what I'd written at home for him, he was gone, and there was Captain Moses once again. Our 3A students quickly went up to Moses and started talking to him excitedly, causing a big commotion. Then they pointed at me. I glanced at Hillam. Why weren't they pointing at him? He had also gotten A's while Moses was gone. I could clearly see that Captain Moses was getting so mad as they spoke to him that his ears were turning red. Then they began to pulsate with a purple glow. Suddenly, we'd no more than taken our seats, and Moses came rushing across the room straight at me and ordered me to get out of my seat and stand at attention. He began to yell at me and poke me in the chest with his index finger so hard that it really hurt. "Give me back your papers," he ordered. "I don't know what you did to that teacher while I was gone, but you will not get away with this anymore." I quickly handed him my papers as I'd been ordered, including the one I'd just written last night about Midnight Duke and a mare giving birth. Moses took my papers and he went to his desk, not giving me permission to sit back down, and brought out his big red marker and began going over my papers with a vengeance. I stood there feeling all alone and so terrible that I could cry. Another thing I'd noticed that Mr. Swift had done was that he'd graded all of our papers in pencil, and lightly, too, like he respected the work that we did. But Moses, he was now marking up my paper with an anger and frustration that I'd only seen with castrated geldings when they'd mount a mare, but they couldn't get anything going. He was sweating by the time he finished marking up my first paper, and he now crossed out the A which had been penciled in, laughed, and put a huge D across the paper, and said aloud to all the class, "He's such an ignorant farm kid that he thinks that animals are human and can think and have reason." All the class laughed at me, especially the three A students. The only one who didn't laugh at me was Hillam. He was looking down at the floor, and I could see he was feeling real bad for me. Having given me a D, Moses now went after my second paper, and this time he crossed out the A before he'd even read my paper. Then, after going over this paper, he laughed and told the class how I'd written about my dog Shep disappearing to lead my brother's soul to heaven when he died. He then told everyone that science had proved that there was no such thing as a soul, and also that he'd personally known my brother Joseph when he'd attended the Army-Navy Academy, and that Joseph Villaseñor had been a real cadet and not afraid to go out for football like I was, and that I was a little sissy Catholic who liked to wear a dress and help the priest say Mass. I lowered my head. This was awful. My mother had gotten me a special pass to leave school early on Fridays so I could learn to be an altar boy, but I'd failed. I hadn't been a good enough reader to be an altar boy either. Moses now made this second D even larger than the first with his red marker. In fact, I could see the D from clear across the room where I was standing at attention. I had tears running down my face, but I was afraid to wipe them for fear that I'd get into even more trouble. Then Captain Moses took hold of my third paper that I'd handed in, the one on which I'd written my full name, Victor Edmundo Villaseñor, when normally I only wrote Victor Villaseñor, and the first thing he did was lash a line across Edmundo, wrote E-D-M-O-N-D in huge letters, and laughed again, this time telling the whole class that I was so stupid I didn't even know how to spell my own name, and he gave me a huge F without reading any of this paper. I remember very well that something snapped inside of me at this point. I don't know what it was, but I pulled back my shoulders and stood up as tall as I could, happy that I wasn't seated. And now I stared at Moses, no longer ashamed of the tears that were running down my face, because these tears, they no longer flowed out of my eyes with fear, but with pure white, gut-gripping rage. I was a cadet no longer. I was now a warrior, an ancestral brave, hearing the beat, beat, beating of my heart as I'd never heard my heart beating before. Never again would I ever pee in my pants at school or at night when I slept because, simply, I now knew that I was going to kill this teacher Moses who stood before me, just as I'd helped kill well over 100 head of livestock on the ranch in the last 10 years. I was no longer in the third grade and hunting in the hills behind our home with a BB gun or a bow and arrow set that was too big for me. I now hunted birds with a 20-gauge shotgun, rabbits and squirrels with a .22 rifle, and I hunted deer with my dad's .30-30 Winchester lever-action saddle gun. In fact, last year at the age of 13, I'd taken and passed my hunter's safety course, gotten my first California state hunting license, and I'd taken my first buck with my dad's rifle with a 300-yard running shot. I was excellent with weapons and horses. Absolutely excellent. And I also knew how to track and read terrain better than anyone I knew. No one in all my school had ever hunted or taken as much game as I'd taken. And so, looking at this man in uniform before me, I now knew that never again would I ever get so scared of him or anyone else that I'd feel like pissing. No, now I was set. I was in that smooth, all-true place that my dad had explained to me that every good man had to get to so he could defend his home, his casa, his familia, as my dad had done with his mother and sisters in the Mexican Revolution. My heart was beating like a mighty drum, and the tears were running down my face, but I wasn't the least bit scared or nervous anymore. No, I was now simply at this place called a Mexican standoff, or un gallo de estaca. Moses was now shouting at me, ordering me to sit down, but I no longer heard him. No, I was good where I was, right here, standing on my own 2 feet. I was excellent, in fact, here at my own safe spot, and I'd never be messed with again. Because, simply, from now on, if anyone pushed me or insulted me, I'd kill them, just as I'd killed that deer. And why? Because, simply, a person's name was sacred, given to us by people who loved us. And my name, E-D-M-U-N-D-O, had been given to me by me papa, who told me that he'd given me this name because one time when he'd been in prison, my dad had gone to prison 3 times, a big, huge cook called Patas Chicas, meaning little feet, because his feet were so monstrous, had taken my dad, a Mexican Indian like himself, under his wing, and tried to teach my dad how to read, explaining to my father that reading and writing weren't just white people's tools, but also the future for nuestra gente. The huge cook had read the book called The Count of Monte Cristo in Spanish to my dad. That book's hero was named Edmundo Dantes, and he'd been sent to prison unjustly, but he escaped, found a treasure, and was then free to avenge himself on all those who'd put him in prison and stolen his bride-to-be. But then, Edmundo had found a light even higher than revenge, and that had been amor. A Frenchman named Dumas had written that book, and that Frenchman, Little Feet told me, Papa, had been a black man, the son of a slave straight from Africa, and on his 50th birthday, that gigantic black man had a harness made for him out of leather that he'd put over his shoulders, and he'd then gotten up in the hayloft over his stables and raised a draft horse 1 foot off the ground with his legs and back muscles. This, my dad told me, was the story that had given him, mi papa, the guts, the wings, the hope with which to survive prison. And he, just being a boy of 13, and all those monsters in prison trying to rape him. "And so I named you Edmundo," my dad told me with tears in his eyes, "to give you the strength de corazón, to never give up, no matter what twists life throws at you or how impossible it all might seem at times. You are Edmundo, Victor Edmundo, the victor over all odds, just like Edmundo Dantes." And here this teacher, Captain Moses, had ridiculed my name, a sacred name, changing it into something else, with no respect for me or mi familia whatsoever, just like what had been done to the slaves that had been brought over from Africa and the Indians who'd been run out of their sacred lands and put on reservations. Yes, with all my heart, I was going to not just kill Moses, but gut shoot him, then rope him and pull him upside down into a tree like we did to the livestock that we butchered. Then I'd cut him open from rib to rib, making sure he didn't die, so he could watch his intestines slip out of his middle. And then he'd scream when I poured a sack full of live rats over him to eat him alive. Now I was the one who was smiling a nasty little smile as I stood there in class, having these juicy good thoughts of revenge. Captain Moses continued shouting at me to sit down. "That's an order! Take your seat, cadet!" But I didn't. I just stood there calmly looking at him. I was free. Never again would I let myself get trapped and enslaved with fear like had happened to me since the first day that we'd started school and they'd slapped Ramon, the best and bravest and smartest of us all, until he'd been bloody, terrifying the rest of us. I breathed as I looked at Moses yelling at me, and I felt as strong and free as when I went home and passed through the gates of our huge Rancho Grande. And I knew then that nothing bad could ever happen to me again because I had familia, and their blood pounded strong in my corazón. I was set now. I was free. I'd found my place, this warm, secure place from where I could look out on the world without fear. Never again would I get so scared that I couldn't hold my pee. The second alarm went off. Class was over. I'd never sat down. I'd beat Moses, and everyone had seen it, too. I picked up my books. I was the last one to go out of our classroom. All of my classmates were already outside assembling, so we could be marched to our next classroom. Suddenly, as I walked outside, our 3A students rushed at me, hitting me with their shoulders so hard that I was knocked to the ground. My books and notebook went flying. They gave me a few quick kicks to the ribs, then slapped fives with one another. I couldn't breathe. They'd really kicked me hard. Quietly, I picked up my books and notebook, but strangely enough, I could see that, well, I wasn't really feeling as intimidated or scared as I normally would have been. George Hillam came over, but he didn't help me pick up my things this time.
"You fool," he said under his breath to me. "You've really done it this time. Don't you know? You can't fight the establishment. You can have those thoughts. We all do, even with our parents. But you can't be staring at people straight in the face, telling them with your eyes that you want to kill them, without them getting you."
I was all confused. Hillam was always so quick to understand everything, like so many other fat people that I knew, that he always confused me.
"Moses told them to get you," he added. "That's why I can't help you. They'll get me then, too."
"Oh," I said, looking behind me and seeing that Moses had watched the whole thing and that he was now putting on his military cap and walking off to be with the other teachers at the head of our assembly.
"Now I get it," I said to Hillam. "Then this is war."
So now realizing the situation, I quickly finished picking up my things and tried to think about all the military maneuvers that we'd studied in our military history courses. They'd really hurt me bad, and it was Walrick who'd kicked me the worst. I took a big breath, glanced around, and tried to figure out a way to avenge myself. I spotted the new blonde cadet named Igo, who was from North Hollywood, and his mother or uncle or someone in his family was in the movie business. Igo was still so new that he didn't have any friends yet. He was a big, husky, strong-looking kid. So I got next to him when we lined up to be marched to our next class. We were all standing at attention to be counted off when I poked Igo in the ribs and instantly got back to attention with my eyes straight forward.
"Stop it,"
said Igo, and he turned and poked me back. Hearing the commotion, Walrick, our top A student and class leader, turned and saw Igo poking at me.
"Knock it off, Igo," he barked.
"But he poked me first," said Igo.
"Did you poke Igo first?" asked Walrick of me.
"Not me, sir," I said, lying, and pretending like I was so scared that I'd never lie or misbehave. "He's a lot bigger and stronger than me. I'd never do that."
Feeling satisfied that I was a coward and knew my place, Walrick turned back around to present our class to the extended assembly of cadets and instructors. Quickly, I poked Igo again, sticking my tongue out at him this time. Igo, a big, easygoing guy, laughed and hit me on the shoulder. And Walrick, true to form,
turned and saw our commotion again, and realized that the other assembly leaders were waiting for him to bring his class to order. He got so mad, he came racing into our ranks and got in Igo's face. "You screw up one more time, Igo," he barked, "and I'll see you before mess hall behind the barracks to teach you how to follow orders." "But sir, he's the one who..." "Don't sir me. I'm a sergeant. I work for a living."
"But sergeant, he's the one who's doing all the..."
The eyes of our A student leader were bloodshot with rage. He glanced at me, but I was standing at attention with my shoulders back, looking completely military proper and scared, so our brilliant leader was just sure that I was too chicken shit to be doing anything wrong.
"Don't be lying to me!"
He turned, barking at Igo. "Meet me behind the barracks if you have any balls."
"Well, okay, I'll be there, but honestly, he's the one who..."
"Attention!" barked Walrick.
"I will not have anyone in my squad making me look bad."
I'll never forget. We went to our next class, but we couldn't pay attention because we were all so excited. Then we were dismissed to clean up before mess hall, meaning lunch, and we all rushed behind our barracks to see if this whole thing was really going to go down. And there was Walrick, stripped to the waist, and it was easy to see that he was the biggest, strongest kid that we had in the whole seventh grade. He had already started shaving, was almost 6 feet tall, and looked like he should be a junior or senior in high school, and yet he was only about 13 years old like the rest of our class. In fact, because I'd flunked the third grade, I was actually about a year older than most of the kids in my grade, but I had such a baby-smooth face that nobody believed that I was as old as I was. Walrick was flexing his arms and cracking his knuckles, and Igo, he finally showed up, but you could see that he really didn't want to fight, and yet he'd do it to save face. The other cadets made a ring around Walrick and Igo. Myself, I kept back out of sight because I didn't want Igo to see me and suddenly decide to come running after me instead of going after Walrick. Everyone was betting on Walrick to win, but myself, I figured that Igo had a good chance because I'd horsed around with him a few days back and I'd seen how quick he was. With fire in his eyes, Walrick came swinging and cursing at Igo, telling him how he was going to teach him a lesson because he wasn't going to allow anyone in his squad ruining his chances of eventually becoming the adjutant cadet of the whole school and then going on to West Point. Igo hit him. Igo hit Walrick with a straight right to the face while our A student leader was talking about his future. It shocked Walrick. In fact, it shocked all of us. Walrick stopped and reached up to his lip with a right hand. Then he looked at his fingertips, saw the blood, and his eyes went crazier than before. Bellowing, he now went rushing in on Igo again. But the kid from North Hollywood was really fast, so he just sidestepped and hit Walrick with two more quick lefts to the face, then a right uppercut to his middle. We all groaned with the sound of the hit to the stomach. Igo really knew how to box, but Walrick was bigger and stronger. He wasn't our class leader for nothing, so he didn't go down. No, he caught his breath and now lunged at Igo, got him in a headlock, and started twisting Igo's head off of his neck with all his might, and then began kneeing him to the body. Igo cried out in pain, but he was tough too, so he now lifted Walrick off of the ground, threw him down, and now they were both pounding on each other as they rolled around on the grass. My God, I'd never meant for all this to happen. I'd just been trying to even the scorecard a little with Moses and our A students, who'd knocked me down and kicked me. Well, the fight continued until they were both a bloody mess. But you could tell that Igo had won, and now he had lots of friends. At this point, we all had to go to our rooms to clean up before we could go to lunch. But when Igo saw me, he forgot all about lunch and took off after me, saying he was going to kill me. I had a head start, so I took off running and hid behind the trash cans, where it smelled so bad that I figured he wouldn't want to search for me very much. It worked. He left, but then, right after lunch, Igo spotted me again, and this time I didn't have much of a lead,
so I knew that he was going to catch me because I wasn't that fast of a runner. I ran down alongside a building, trying to figure out what to do real quick. Then I remembered how my dad had taught me to set traps for rabbits, as he'd done in the middle of the Mexican Revolution to get food for his mother and sisters who'd been starving. Rounding the far corner of the big building, I pulled out my pen and pencils from my book bag, selected one pencil because it was recently sharpened, and held it out like a spear as I heard Igo coming around the corner at a full-out run. And he was fast, too, so he hit the end of my sharpened pencil with his chest at full speed, which drove the pencil into him. Seeing the big, long, yellow pencil sticking out of his chest, I'd let go of it the moment I felt it penetrate. He screamed in terror and started turning pale and began to gasp. "You killed me!" he screamed. "You got me in the heart!" "No, I didn't," I said, having butchered a lot of livestock. "Your heart is over here, more on your other side. Besides, I never drove it. I just held it and you ran yourself into it, just like a rabbit running on a trail into a trap of sharp sticks." "I'm going to get lead poisoning," he said, looking weak with fear. "I'll yank it out," I offered. "No!" he screamed. But I'd already grabbed it and yanked it out. He fell down, crying.
"Get me to the infirmary," he begged. "I don't want to die."
"You won't," I said. "I've poked myself with a pencil before and I didn't die."
"But I can get lockjaw," he said. "Come on, help me up. I need to get to the infirmary."
"All right, I'll help you up. But no more trying to get even with me. I'm sorry that I got you into that fight with Walrick, but I never expected it to go that far. I just wanted to get a little bit even with him for knocking me down and then kicking me. Besides," I added, "you beat him, so you'll never have any more problems here at school. Hell, you should be happy with me. You're a hero now."
"You sick bastard," he said. "You had the whole thing planned since that first time you poked me, didn't you?"
I smiled, but said nothing more. Then, getting to the nurse's office, Igo did something that I'll never forget. He didn't turn me in for having stabbed him or setting up the whole fight. He simply told the nurse that he'd fallen on his own pencil. We became good friends, and Moses, when he found out that Igo had beaten the crap out of his top pet A student and that Igo and I had become friends, he didn't like the smell of the whole thing, but he didn't send his bully pets after me anymore. Still, I didn't win the war. Only a few battles here and there. George Hillam was right, you couldn't fight the establishment. And Moses just kept at me, giving me as bad of grades as he could and ridiculing me in front of everyone, until finally he had me so beaten down once again that I actually began to hate Mr. Swift for ever having given me any hope. I was stupid. There was no getting around it. And spelling and punctuation were what mattered, not what you dreamed or loved to do. Still, as sure as the sun went down and the moon came up at night, it was now written in my heart and soul, Moses was a dead man.
Chapter 3. Getting up that morning in Long Beach, I never found that man from the teachers' union. They said that he'd left, but I did get so many requests for speaking engagements that Karen Black, our publicist, told me that my New York publisher was starting a lecture agency for their authors and that they could do my bookings for my talks for 25% of my fees. I said that I hadn't even realized I was going to be paid, so I'd have to think about it. Then I found out that the most prolific living writer in all the world, the Western writer Louis L'Amour, who had more than 300 million books in print, was going to give the talk at today's luncheon. His book Hondo was one of my all-time favorite books, just like it was one of my all-time favorite Western movies, and Steinbeck, Faulkner, James Joyce, Anne Frank, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Asuela, Rimbaud, and Camus were some of my all-time favorite writers. I met with Louis L'Amour and his wife Catherine and their two kids just before his talk, and I asked him if he had any advice for a new writer. We found a quiet place in the bar, but didn't order drinks, and he said, "First,
A writer writes. That's his job, his work. Second, it's never about money. It's about writing. That's why I didn't get married until I was 50, because I didn't make enough money to be married and also keep writing. And about my book Hondo that you say that you love? I sold it to the movies for $500, and people tell me that I was cheated. I say no. I needed those $500, and they paid me. Movies are free advertisements for our books. I heard that you caused quite a stir yesterday with your talk. That's good. You got their attention. Now go home and write. The thing that ruins more writers than anything is drinking, thinking about the money, wanting to hobnob with the rich and famous, and going to too many conventions like this one. John Wayne has been in 3 movies that were made from my books, and I've had the chance to meet the man several times, but I never have. Why? Because, simply, writing is a job like digging a ditch or building a house, barn, or corrals, and I was too busy writing at those times to meet the man. Early success has ruined more of our best writers than anything else, he added. They write an excellent first book because they had plenty of time and nothing to lose. But then, with the taste of success, they freeze up or start drinking and hobnobbing or thinking that they should go into politics, and they never get a second book out of the same quality or intensity. So keep your powder dry and dig in for a long, fruitful life of being a writer, that storyteller around the campfire of your people and your generation. Your trade is as old as time, and your main job is to uplift the human heart so that then we can go on with dignity and fair play. That's it. I was stunned. I'd never expected to be given so much, and all in a nutshell. He then told his wife to give me their home number, and he told me to call them any time, day or night, because he'd read the first few pages of my book Macho, and he could tell that I was the real thing, as the author Hemingway always liked to say. I got in my Ford van, my white stallion, and drove home, feeling 10 feet tall and 10 years older than when I'd driven up to Long Beach only 30-some hours ago. A few days later, the Long Beach paper came out with a big picture of me in a long article. Then the LA Times ran a feature story on me, too. A few weeks later, I couldn't believe it. The Times also reviewed my book, comparing Macho to the best of John Steinbeck, the great writer himself. Oh, I was on my way. I had to breathe real easy just to keep calm. I was flying so high.
Book 2. Chapter 4. I was 5 years old. The year was 1945. My father, Juan Salvador Villaseñor, walked me from our old ranch house up to the corrals to talk with me. Mijito, he said, tomorrow you'll be starting school, so it's important for you to understand who you are and who your people are. You are un Mexicano, and Mexicanos are such good, strong people that everywhere everyone wants to be a Mexican. Look at what used to happen back in the barrio in Carlsbad. The gringos and the negros would come to our pool hall, eat a few enchiladas, drink a couple of tequilas, and then they'd start to sing with the mariachis. That's proof that everyone loves the Mexicans and wants to be un Mexicano. Get it? I nodded.
Yes, I get it, Papa.
Good, because now that you're starting school, you have to be a good little man and start studying the girls. So when your time comes, you'll know how to choose the right wife. Because the most important thing any man can do in all his life is pick the right woman to breed with. I mean, marry first, then breed. Because from the woman comes the instinct to survive, I said, having heard this for as long as I could remember.
Good, said me Papa.
Very good. You remembered. And so, for you to be attractive to girls, mijito, you can't be picking your nose anymore and wiping it off on your pants. Do you understand? Lo cortés no quita lo valiente, y lo valiente no quita lo cortés. This I'd also heard for as long as I could remember, and it was one of our oldest Mexican dichos, sayings, and what it said was that manners didn't take away bravery, and that bravery didn't diminish manners. Yes, I said, nodding, I think I do. And also, said my dad, as he continued smoking his big, long cigar and we passed under the huge old pepper tree, from now on, you got to be responsible. And this starts with every man and woman knowing how to wipe their own ass. I nodded again. I was listening real closely to every word that mi papa was telling me, because growing up on a ranch with horses and cattle and big trucks and tractors, I'd learned that if you didn't pay attention real close to what you were told, the next thing you'd know, you'd be run over by a tractor, or be on horseback and have your saddle slip out from under you. Or worse still, you'd have a rattlesnake scare the living shit out of you because you hadn't been paying attention to where the father sun was in the sky and been watching out for the shady spots on the trail. But still, I was having a hard time listening to my dad because my brain just kept jumping around inside of my head. Hell, I'd never been away from mi familia before. And why did I need to go to school anyway? I was learning everything that I needed to learn there on the ranch. I knew how to milk a cow to get milk. I knew how to plant and grow corn so we could make tortillas. What else was there for me to learn? So, are you understanding me, mijito? My father now said to me, puffing on his cigar. You're going to have to now know how to be out on your own. I shook my head. No, papa. I really don't understand, I said in Spanish. I didn't know any English. All we ever spoke on the ranch was Spanish. How can I stop picking my nose when my mocos get dry? Mocos means snot in Spanish. And begin to itch, they hurt if I don't pick them. And my ass, I've never really figured out how to clean it real good yet. Do I bunch the toilet paper together, Papa? Or do I lay it out on the floor and fold it real carefully so that it stays flat when I wipe myself? Who showed you to lay it out flat and fold it? Asked my father. I never thought of that. I've always just bunched it together. My God, mijito, look at you. You haven't even started school yet, and already you've come up with a very good idea. I tell you, you're going to do good in school. Hell, you're already thinking. And that's what education is really all about, learning how to think. Well, I felt good hearing this, but still I didn't like the idea that I was going to have to go to school. Can I at least go to school on horseback? I now asked. I'd been riding horses since I was 3, and on top of a big horse, I felt like Superman, faster than a speeding bullet and stronger than a locomotive. No, I don't think so, said my dad. Why not? Uncle Archie said that when he went to school, half the kids on the reservation went on horseback, and they got to take their rifles too so they could hunt for game on their way home for supper. My dad pushed back his Stetson and scratched his head. That was a long time ago, mijito. We can't just go riding or carrying guns into town anymore. We're civilized nowadays. I really didn't like hearing this. I figured that I'd have a hell of a lot better chance at school if I could take my horse and my trusty BB gun rifle. On foot, I was still pretty damn short. And going into any new territory, I'd found out that I had a better chance if I went on horseback and was well armed. I could hardly sleep that night. I was so nervous. I kept tossing and turning, and my older brother and sister were no help, because I'd learned so far in life that you had to take your own lumps when a horse threw you. Nothing anybody could tell you about getting bucked off could prepare you for the first time you ate dirt and felt so stunned that your brain couldn't even work until you'd taken a few breaths. But then, after eating dirt 2 or 3 times, getting bucked off wasn't all that bad anymore. I'd found this out firsthand. Monday morning, I got up extra early, washed, brushed my teeth, pulled up my bedding, laid out my clothes, and put on my new Levi's and the new long-sleeve checkered shirt my mother had gotten for me at JCPenney in downtown Oceanside. I loved going to Penny's with my mother, because at Penny's, they had a jar attached to a wire that they'd put your money in when you paid for something, and the jar was then pulled on a wire real fast up to a little window above the store floor. The jar would then somehow miraculously slow down just as the window woman reached out, took the jar, opened it, took out your money, made your change, wrote out a receipt, and then put everything back in the jar and pulled the cord, and the jar came flying back down on the wire as fast as a bird with its ass on fire. Also, I loved pennies because, like my mother Lupe always said, our pennies went further at Penny's than they did at Sears. But still, Sears was where we got most of our farm and horse equipment. After breakfast, my mother took me into the bathroom and wiped off the egg that I'd gotten on my new shirt. I could now see that my mother had been very smart in insisting I get a checkered shirt instead of the plain blue one that I'd wanted, because the wiped wet area where she'd cleaned on my shirt was hardly even visible with all of the checkers. When my mother was done cleaning me, she left, and I stayed behind in the bathroom alone. I peed in our toilet that was stained all orange from our hard well water. Then I got up on my little box so I could see myself in the mirror over the sink, which was also stained orange, and I saw that my hair was just about all combed down except where it always stood straight up in the back like the quills of a porcupine. Standing on the box, I made the sign of the cross over myself and began talking with God. "Papito," I said, "you might have forgotten, because you're so busy and all, but today I'm going to school all alone, and I'm just a little kid, especially when I'm on foot. So I'll need for you to please stay by my side and help me out in case I do something dumb and get in trouble. Okay? Do we got a deal, Papito? You'll stay by my side, eh?" Making my request, I now closed my eyes real tight, like mi mamá grande Doña Guadalupe had taught me to do, so I could then hear the voice of God inside of me. But what I heard next, I don't think was the voice of Papito, because now I heard my mother shouting, "Hurry up! You don't want to be late on your first day of school!" My heart started pounding. Quickly, I made the sign of the cross once again and said, "See you at school, God," and ran out of our smelly old bathroom, past the kitchen, out the back door, and to our car. I opened the car door, pushed the chicken off the passenger's seat where she'd no doubt decided to nest, and my mother and I were off, with chicken feathers flying all over us. Usually my mother went to work at about this same time, but this morning she was going to drop me off at school, then go to downtown Oceanside to do her bookkeeping at our main liquor store, which was located just up from the train station near the pier. I loved the Oceanside Pier. This was where Uncle Archie would sometimes take me fishing. My mother drove us out from under the two huge pepper trees, past our grouping of Torrey pines, and drove down the long driveway of our huge Rancho Grande, underneath the umbrella of tall eucalyptus trees. "You're going to love school," said my mother. "Going to school with your godmother Manuelita back in La Lluvia de Oro were some of the best days of my life." "But weren't you a little scared on your first day, Mama?" "Yes, I guess I was. But your godmother Manuelita was the teacher's helper, and she walked with me to school. Don't worry," she added. "You'll make friends. And then with friends, school and life are much easier, mijito." I hoped that my mother was right, because living on a ranch, I didn't know any kids my own age, much less have any friends. I guess that my dog Sam had been the closest thing that I'd ever had to a friend, but then he'd gotten run over by our German friends Hans and Helen Hulster about a year back. I was looking out our car window as we drove. I could see that there were dozens of wild ringneck pheasants in our orchards of lemons and oranges. Seeing those beautiful birds gave my heart wings. Then we passed the dark orchard.